Hello, and welcome to the Medical AI Podcast, a 30-minute thrill ride of big ideas. We are Dr. Felix Beecher and Joe McKeating, and we talk to a range of top guests, from scientists to industry innovators to philosophers.
This is the Medical AI Podcast, where we explore the nexus of healthcare and artificial intelligence. I'm your host, Joe McKeating. Joining me today is Anitha Kannan, the head of machine learning and founding member at CureEye, which is a healthcare company providing affordable and accessible primary care access to everyone using machine learning and artificial intelligence. Anitha, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Joe. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I thought that originally going through your entire career, which we'll hit on, would be a good place to start. But then I thought a better jumping off point would be this. You had a PhD in machine learning a full 2 decades before most people even had heard of machine learning. So how did you get into this space so early on, and what motivated you to do so?
It's a great question. It's somewhat accidental, I would say, that I actually learned about AI and machine learning at that time. So this was my final year at undergrad program, and I was thinking about grad school and what to do. And I've done a couple of courses in networking and databases and things like that. And I was not gelling very much. And then I was talking to my uncle, who had spent a few years at Bell Labs and also at CMU. And I was talking to him about it. And he mentioned, oh, you know what? When I was in Bell Labs, there were folks working on AI. And he walked me through different types of AI. And in particular, one thing that, there's like knowledge representation, there are expert systems that are much more manual, rule-based things. And they didn't excite me, but there was one thing that he said that caught my attention, which was really what machine learning is about, right? So there's like this bunch of work that is starting to appear, which is about collecting data of a task that you're interested in, feeding that to a software, and the software learns from it, and being able to generalize to examples it hasn't seen during training. And if you think about it, this is like building an intelligent software with a piece of code that you really write. And the field is very nascent. There's hardly anyone very few really working on that at that space, and which really meant that this can go for a very long time, because humans really want to automate stuff. Things that are boring for us, we probably want to automate a lot, but then if they can do it very intelligently, it's going to be even more fun. So that's where it sparked my interest at that time. And then I started to look around for academic institutions where you had advisors who were working in machine learning. And that's pretty much how my journey started. And what kept me going, maybe I can add to that, is that my very first project that I did was clustering data points. So you have these really high dimensional data points that you need to cluster, and humans can't really do it very well. And this was a MATLAB program. I don't think MATLAB and machine learning goes together these days. But I think at that time in the late 90s and early 2000s, you would write, even for neural nets training, you would write in MATLAB code. And we wrote this code, and I had this visualization where after every iteration of model training, you could see really good clusters emerging. It's still not a fully solved problem at that time, but good clusters. And I think I keep thinking about that particular thing, the awe factor I had. And so I think that's what kept me going for the last 20 years, I would say.
So I'm curious, even in your early academic career, and you're in kind of a subset of computer science, were your other the other students at the time, your peers in computer science, did they think, wow, artificial intelligence, machine learning, you're learning about these things, that is just the coolest thing ever? Or were they a little bit confused about what you were doing? Like, what was the attitude, say, in the late 90s towards that?
I think it's a very niche community. There's a small, I mean, luckily ended up in University of Toronto, where there's like a really good, strong set of machine learning professors, right? You start with Jeff Hinton, Brendan Fry, Ed Semmel, Sam Rowes. There's so many machine learning professors that are extremely good at the craft. And because it was like a hub for machine learning, there were like professors across the entire country and in the UK, and for instance, like just traveled through us. Like we would have so many external speakers speaking. So I think within the community of machine learning people, maybe there's a community of just about 100 people at that time. There was enough of what I should say is enthusiasm that we could keep going. And I think that maybe for people outside who are working on databases or networking, which are super popular at that time, they might have thought that we were just like what we were doing. Maybe that was what they thought. But because I've had friends, grad school friends who were like, what are you working on these things? Right. But I think there was like something that kept us going is what I would say. And if you look at today's machine learning and where we are, especially this last 1 year, I feel like that's just and where almost everyone in the world probably knows about some form of machine learning, either through ChatGPT or otherwise. If you think about it, it's just culmination of or maybe reaching one of the peaks of the culmination of a lot of work that were 20, 30 years of people's work, both positive outcomes and negative outcomes that have come together to, you know, to get to this place. So it's just great to see that kind of a progress. And often it just requires a small group of people believing in it, I guess.
And for the sake of listeners, one of the first professors you mentioned there, Jeff Hinton, has become very famous in recent times to even a broader community, featured on 60 Minutes and other places, referred to often as the godfather of AI. So the fact that at your University of Toronto days, you were studying in some of the labs that he was running is very interesting. One more question sticking in this era of your studies. If you would have thought 2023 at that stage, would you have thought we'd be farther along, or would you have been mind blown where we are today?
It's a hypothetical question, isn't it? I would say that I was blown away because today, I don't know if I would have characterized it, what this impact would be. I think there's two dimensions to it. One is people in the community feeling this and then people outside the community feeling it. I think those two are not something that is very easy to comprehend. And I'm still blown away. So we used to work with large language models for a while now, like trying out every open source models and all the GPTs as well. And then when we got early access to GPT-4 and last October, it took me like at least 30 minutes to kind of just really understand what is going on, because we have seen the evolution, we have seen how it works. And it was like mind boggling for me, even for me, like where the NLP has become. And what I think the biggest thing that OpenAI did that I'm just grateful for is that they released ChatGPT that allows the world to feel it, right? It's very hard for a community to say, oh, AI can come and help you in all these different facets of disciplines of work. It takes people to try it out and feel it and kind of agree on it. It's similar to virtual care practice. If you think about it, COVID was really a terrible thing to happen to the world. But then the minute we had virtual care practice where people can get on a call or talk to it immediately, and that was the only forcing function, if you will. Like it doesn't, people started to feel that, oh, you could do some of these things online, right? I remember like in 2017, when I was talking to people, when we started this company, I don't think many people believed that you can do things on a virtual practice as much, right? So I think that kind of a bigger feeling, more people realizing the scope is where things actually matters. And I think that's what happened with these, both of these, I think, in the last 3-4 years. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I'm definitely GPT-4, but even 3.5 before that, you started to get a sense of, oh, this this train's really moving. Whereas before that, I remember using GPT-3 even just for fun to see where the technology was to help write certain articles. I had an article about virtual reality versus mixed reality versus whatever else. And I had it written using GPT-3. And then I said, written by artificial intelligence, annotated by a human. And although I was impressed with it, my feedback was pretty harsh as well. I mean, the hallucinations at that time were off the wall. It would just say some things that were clearly so not right and seemed more like a novelty. But yeah, by the time 3.5 and especially 4 came about, it became pretty evident that we are in a new era of going about this. I wanted to get back to...
Yeah, to add to that, you are spot on with this because we even published a paper as well, how to simulate data from GPT-3. And we had to put in a lot of constraints on correctness of the simulation and throw away hallucinations and try and see whether that would work. But it was still feeble signal. So totally agree with that, what you're saying.
And even, well, I want to get back to Curie, but then at another part later in this conversation, I want to get back to the hallucinations because people talk about the hallucinations. And for listeners who aren't familiar with that terminology, although I would expect most are, that we're just talking about when, if you were to anthropomorphize the technology, it would be like an eager intern who doesn't want to tell the boss they don't know. So they would just do whatever to make up an answer that sounds credible, sounds possibly believable. And that, especially in a medical context, the stakes could be pretty high there. But also what people don't talk about quite as much is our omissions, which could be just as dangerous in a medical context. But let's get back to that in a minute. I want to talk more about, actually briefly on your path to get here as well, just so that listeners are familiar. We talked about University of Toronto. You are also at, and you can go over these quickly, but AI research at Facebook, at Microsoft. And then I really want you to talk about what is going on at Curie, what made you believe in that mission and what your goals are there.
Yeah, I had the I was just very fortunate to spend most of my time outside of Curie at Microsoft Research, both in the Cambridge labs and in the UK, and also at here in Silicon Valley, and also in Redmond Lab for some time, and then moved to Facebook AI Research as well. Spent a few years, but I think the general theme I had over those years are twofold. Right, one is really about the experience that the thing that my uncle taught me at that time, and I told you about, like, you know, the research is well ahead of where technology can go. And I think I got stuck to that a very lot, and I still believe that companies succeed when they have that space and time for exploratory work, and you can see that through the history. And so these labs were extremely important, just like my grad school. These labs were important in honing my skills and being able to think about problem long term and sit on it for a very long time and be part of something bigger than each person. And I don't know, is there anything you particularly you are asking for in that space? Otherwise, I can tell you more about Curie, the one I'm really excited about.
Yeah, let's get on to Curie. I think we'll tie back into kind of transitioning from a researcher to product in a little bit. But let's talk about Curie first, and then we can talk about that.
Yeah. So it's very easy to think about Curie if you kind of spend a second thinking about the times when you wish you had access to a doctor. If you're a doctor already, I think a lot of doctors want to spend a lot of time with the patients. And it's not like one contiguous amount of time, but they do want to be available for their patients. And that's just so impossible. But if you are a patient, if you're not a doctor, I'm sure everyone has gone through at least one time in their lives where they wish they had access to someone they can talk to, an expert, right? And literally about 99% of the world's population cannot get access to a doctor immediately. And if you in the US, if you don't have insurance, I think it's almost impossible. Right? My own personal story with my father and caring for him. And we were very lucky and fortunate to have a team of expert doctors we can rely on towards his last 5 years of his life. And after his death, I was looking for something more meaningful. And so that was one part of me where, how can I be part of a solution to healthcare space where people can get the kind of care my father got over the years? You know, I think almost every founding team member in healthcare space always have these stories that drives them and keeps them going. And then mine is one of those as well. And then the cool thing about being in a research labs is that you get to see where the research is, where is it really going? And being at FAIR, looking at NLP, for instance, like Google Translate came like in 2006, right? But then it took another 10 years to actually have a really credible translation system that really works. And then you look at the progress in NLP, natural language processing in general, we are seeing a lot of progress. And it just feels like there's going to be a pinnacle here at some time in the real future. So I was like, okay, so the technology is getting there in AI. And if you think about 2016, there was even like dermatology level AI paper coming from Stanford as well, right? And so there's a lot of these people are getting interested in healthcare. There is technology coming in. And then here is me looking for something that is meaningful because I see that there's a place for it. And what I realized is that you really need to be in a place where both of these are equally important. You cannot be in a research lab where you don't have access to expert clinicians, people, subject expert matters, right? I've felt that when I was doing genomics work at Microsoft Research, working with Sanger Institute at that time. So I felt like I need to play in a place where, you know, both of these are equally important. And then I happened to know one of the founders, Xavier Ramachan, and he reached out. And I always say that people could be starting any company and anything in a healthcare space, but it was so much aligned with what I was looking for. And then I talked to Neil Khosla, who's our CEO, and I basically asked him only one question, which is like, how long do you think this will take? Because I really wanted to know what that answer, because that answer is so fundamental if you're thinking about it. And he said, at least 10 years, if not more. And healthcare, to actually get the technology right and to get the, you know, like just really rethink how healthcare should happen, I think that requires that amount of time, that long-term thinking. So I basically decided to join. And I think this last 6 years has been one of my best years, I think, in the career. So what do? Right? We go back to this question of like, having access to the doctors when they need it. So it's like 24/7 service, primary care, chat-based service, where for $15 a month, direct to consumers, you have unlimited access to primary care physicians on a chat-based platform. And where the AI comes in is that because we have access to the entire primary care practice, we look at that blueprint and decide where is AI good at, and legally good, correct to do so, and how can we bring that in and sort of scale the doctors and supercharge them, right? And that's what we look for. So it's still at the end of the day, doctors are making the licensed physician in your own state is making that decision as well. But we look, and the AI is sort of complementing it and sort of amplifying the doctor, right? So for instance, if you go on to our platform today, the AI will be the one that's collecting a lot of the information and then passing it back and sending it to the physicians. And then AI helps the physicians as well. But I think at the end of the day, you do follow up with the AI and so on. So
I think that point about amplifying the doctors is really interesting for this reason. And we can have a whole nother conversation another time about job displacement and these sorts of things, which are very real conversations. But for the sake of this, I just don't want to go too far down that road in this point. I saw somebody make the point maybe a year or so ago that, and I wish I remembered who it was, but that if we wanted the best results, say for kids in grade school to learn algebra, you would have the three best algebra teachers teaching that to millions of students, as opposed to a million algebra teachers, only a small sliver of whom are the top. And in the same way, you could think with healthcare, other considerations aside for a moment, which is another discussion, like I mentioned, but you could, in theory, have every patient not only have access to a primary care physician, you could have every patient have access to the best primary care physician, or the three best, or the top 1% of results driven. So I think that is really interesting. One other point that I wanted to make, when you brought up the 10-year timeline, which I love, I think you really have to, the people who think that they're going to get into a startup, especially a technology startup, and be in and out in 2 years or 3 years, not only is that unrealistic, it's also, in my opinion, just the wrong mentality. So you talked about philosophical alignment. I saw an old video of Jeff Bezos the other day, and he brought up such a I thought, spot on way to talk about this. He said that at Amazon, they acquire a lot of companies. And the number one quality that he looks for in the founders, in the founding team, in the senior executives, he said, are they missionaries or mercenaries? And if they're missionaries, they've spent the time, they're obsessed with the customers, they're obsessed with solving those problems. And if they're mercenaries, they're obsessed with, how do we flip this in 3 years? How do we flip this in 5 years? Which may not seem like a big deal, but in reality, that will destroy the whole philosophy and the alignment with who they're supposed to be serving. And we've seen that with Amazon from day one. Even if people get annoyed with hearing that over and over again, the probably number one key to their success was being obsessed with their customers. Yeah. So anyway, I just say that to say that I love the 10-year timeline point on that. Coming from a research background, and now you're at a product company, what was that adjustment like? What did you learn along the way? Would you suggest to people coming into product that having a research background is a great background to have? And talk a little bit about your experience there.
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I think the reason why I'm saying it's a really good question is, like, when I joined Cura, I think a lot of my own work has been more on the exploratory side, thinking about what does it mean? Like, so you started with even like literally no training data, if you will, right? You're starting a company, you don't have any training data, and you're doing an ML. So you're kind of starting to bootstrap a lot of these things. And so there's a lot of exploration. Now, where the product meets the road is to think about, how does that feed into what you're trying to achieve, right? So for something like healthcare, which is very dominant with experts in the field and requires, and then you're looking at the physicians, the clinical correctness, you're looking at experience for the product, for the patients on the platform, and what works and what doesn't work. So you cannot sit in a silo as a machine learning researcher and kind of try to work through it. You really have to be very collaborative, and you want to have a system that is very collaborative in nature, where all these people are coming together, like from design to clinical expertise to like a product strategy to what is possible with ML machine learning at that time. And all of that come together. And I feel like getting all of these pieces correct is going to be the biggest challenge, and requires a lot of forethought. And I felt like Curai, we actually thought about all of these factors from the get-go. And so it didn't feel like you are moving away from research to very product world at that point. You really felt like, oh, here is our mission. Here is our strategy for our mission. And here is how we need to collectively come together and think about these things. And often some of these technical problems takes a lot of time to think through it. So you want to give the space and time for people to say, okay, this is going to be in an exploratory or a discovery phase, and give that freedom and the thing to be able to do it. We used to even say that some of these projects are more like a go, no-go decision points. Right, where, okay, at the end of this, we are going to decide whether we should pursue this path or not. And we have done quite a bit of that over the years, and have learned a lot from doing these go-no-go decisions. And so for people who are willing to go into product from research, I think the only question is that, are you aligned with the mission? Because a lot of the times researchers have this thing of, which is by craft design, which is more about publications and, you know, community. And we publish at QRI too. But you want to align to the mission, align to the strategy, and then say, how does my work on a daily basis is directed towards that mission and strategy? And is that work paying off? Right. And how do I think about these problems and have the team, the company be in a position where it is celebrating failures as well in research. Right. And I think that's extremely important that that people have that back support. They have that supported by the company for these things.
Yeah. I wonder in reverse, while you were explaining that, I was thinking, put you on the spot here a little bit, but if you had two options to choose from, or say you were giving advice to somebody starting their career right now, do you think it would be more beneficial in the long run to go from research to product, or to start with a product background and then go to research? I guess they could both inform one another in either direction, right?
Yeah, it is. It really, I mean, I don't think there's one size fits all here, Joe. I actually think it's going to be functional. What excites you? Right. And I think machine learning today is far more advanced than it was before. So the question ends up being, what about machine learning are you excited about? Right. So if you're excited about applied work, where I actually want to see some of these things taken into product, then you probably do want to start with the product side, right? But if you're saying, oh, I want to be able to see why is the context window, like I'm looking at natural language processing examples here where you're doing this, giving instructions to the ML, to the model. And I'm interested in more about the nitty-gritty details of how to do efficient inference on those models. Or if I want to understand, how can I expand this to understanding a much, much longer context than it does, right? If you're having those, or how do I make it more aligned to what humans would expect, right? And so you're looking for those kinds of questions that intrigue you. You're probably better off being in research. My question then ends up being, where should you do this research, right? Today, mm-hmm. I feel like you want the best of academia and the best of industry intersecting, right? Because a lot of these large models are probably in big companies that works, and you want to maybe build on top of it versus do you want to rethink it? So I think there's many factors that play into it. I know I'm not giving you a perfect answer because there isn't a perfect answer. It is about each person's self-introspection and talking to people on what interests them and seeing, are you going to be better off being a researcher? Even if you're a researcher, are you better off in industry or in academia, right? And then are you better off in product? So you got to think about those things. If there's anyone in your audience who are interested in it and want to talk about it, I'm happy to do it. But even connect me on LinkedIn and we can chat as well. But I think this is really about each person's individual preferences, less so of one size fits all.
And speaking of the audience, I just remembered that some people will probably be upset with me if I have someone with your background on and we don't get into a little bit more technical questions. Large language models really burst onto the scene in a public way in the past year and a half, maybe 2 years, maybe. But we talked about natural language processing for a while. I mean, I'd built chatbots for clients with Dialogflow, a Google framework, years ago before ChatGPT ever came on the scene or anything like that. So large language models, I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, would be a subset of natural language processing or not an alternative, because it certainly still utilizes that. But just from a technical perspective, we seem to right now be in this era of large language models. We have GPT, we have Claude by Anthropic, we have Google coming out with Bard, and we now have Grok, I believe, would be X's. It would be a new large language model. Do you think, in a healthcare context specifically, but even at large, are we going to remain in this large language model era? Is this where the most value can be derived, or Is it mixing it with other NLP technologies? What do you think?
Yeah, it's a great question. So maybe we should break this apart a little bit more and talk through this, right? So the idea of language model is really about generating the next word given context so far, right? And so that is not a novel thing. Language models existed. And the reason why you have large language models is that now you can actually have trained models that understands longer and longer context so that it can actually spit out a better word, right? So this whole idea that used to be called pre-training before, right, where you can have a large amount of text and you know what the next word is because it's there, and then you can formulate this as a supervised learning problem. So this pre-training or foundational models will continue to be the backbone for all NLP applications. Because what we are noticing is that as we increase the size of these models, they start to have what's called as emerging properties, right? Where you, even when you are after your first level of fine tuning, even if you're tuned on a particular set of tasks, it can actually generalize to tasks. Compared to what we used to say about machine learning, it can generalize to new examples. Now we are saying that it can generalize to new tasks, right? That's where the field has grown. So I don't think large language models are going to go away as the foundational thing. Maybe you may have different architectures, maybe it may be much, and things like that, but I think that is going to be the same. Now, where things start to get very interesting is how do you do fine tuning, or how do you do alignment on those to the preferences of a particular type of work, like if you're in healthcare. I mean, if you look, remember, like Google's MedPalm 2 is about like taking one of these models and then fine-tuning it on question-answering tasks of different kinds that are from healthcare data, right? So you can fine-tune to your class, and you can also use something like RLHF, reinforcement learning, human feedback to align the outcomes to what humans would like. Right. And so you can do all of these things to specialize. And the thing is that the more data you collect and either through human feedback, implicitly or explicitly, you can get more and more alignment to these different tasks. And if you had the other thing we found was that it's very small amount of training data on top of these foundational model, it generalizes to that task even more. Right. So you don't need to have very expensive data set that you're collecting. So that's one line of work, right, where you can bring in your own data and fine-tune task and do better. The other line of work is about something like in healthcare and so on. There's a lot of manually curated works, right? There's all these protocols, all these kinds of things that doctor and very specialized for a particular hospital system and that. Are specialized particular for a particular country and things like that, which probably these foundational models may not know as well. So then there is a question of how do you now augment that? And so this whole area of work on retrieval augmented generation is a stepping stone to bring in your own data and not have to like fully train the model, but actually bringing these protocols in and leveraging them, right? I'm sure there's going to be a flurry of work there, which is on the fly alignment to external knowledge or something that is specific for your own internal stuff coming in together. So, and to ask your question, and so if you look at retrieval augmented generation, even there, you're using techniques from information retrieval fed into this, right? There's an entire area of work on called information retrieval and computer science. And many of the learnings from there is feeding into the space. So you're going to see a lot more of these kinds of cross collaborations within related fields of machine learning that are coming together. But I think the basic foundation will continue to evolve and mature, if that answers my question. If that's sense to you.
No, that's a tremendous answer. Four horsemen of criticism of artificial intelligence is explainability. Can you explain how your model came to this conclusion? In some areas, the stakes are lower. In others, the stakes are higher. If I live in Denver, Colorado, if I ask what is the best gyro in town? And I'm getting lunch, and give me a pretty opinionated answer. Can't explain exactly how it got there. Stakes are pretty low. In a healthcare context, the stakes could be high. So we are moving more in this direction, right, of feeding in more proprietary information. You're a medical practice, your own protocols, which are going to differ a little bit from another practices, say. But where do you think we are, and where do we need to get to, even if we're using these public large language models as the backbone on the explainability side before there's a comfort level there? Or do you think that just takes care of itself with time?
Yeah, I think this is a interesting question, because I think it's a question that we've been fighting for a lot of time. And even when just neural nets were starting to get popular, this was a question. And then there was like all these methods like LIME and so on that was trying to explain with a simpler model the output of a larger model and things like that. But I actually feel like the question may be somewhat, we may want to move on from that question in terms of saying, can I give interpretability and explainability to the reasoning? But there are still techniques that allows for it, right? You can do things like chain of thought prompting, which allows you to give the rationale at every step of the result. So you can see how the AI came to a conclusion that it did for that particular prompt. So there are those approaches that are there, but I don't think I'm convinced that they are useful for the kind of things that you're looking for. Right? They help you to help the AI to do more reasoning, get into a better local optima for answering a question. But I'm not sure that that's like says that the rational that it produces is a correct rational. So how do you check the rational it said as a correct rational? Right. So yes. I feel like there has to be some notion of external evidences supported that you may want to do it. And oftentimes it really, the stakes depends on what are you trying to do with it. So at Curie, what we are doing is that at the end of the day, the doctors are making the decision, and the doctors are the ones who are doing, or if there's errors that the AI produces, they're correcting it and gives us a feedback to improve on it. Right? So I feel like I think it's important for us as a community to start thinking about where are these applications used and how are they used and what can we do to strengthen our, what kind of metrics? I mean, something that we're working on a lot is for omission and hallucination. Like, what kind of metrics can you do to kind of really tease out to make it go in the right direction, or guardrails? I know there's so many other ways that we can kind of put bells and whistles and ensure that it's doing the right job, rather than trying to go down the path of LIME or any of those techniques that are more about taking the output and interpreting and using a smaller model, I think.
I have noticed in ChatGPT that it has started giving and really promoting you to look into its analysis a little bit better. And I would say that you would have to be not even moderately technical to understand what it's doing. You could read through it and I think pretty well figure out.
Yeah, but Joe, you have to remember that I think I'm a big fan of this kind of work, but I'm also wanted to say that just because a rational is given doesn't mean the rational is correct always.
Oh, of course.
Right? Of course. So at least you can, I think what we want to do is orthogonal techniques, orthogonal evaluation metrics, designing our own evaluation metrics, designing our ways of seeing whether it's actually following instructions, and then evaluating those, right? So evaluations of these generative outputs, I think, is like the biggest thing we should be really spending a lot of time on. That I don't think as a machine learning community has spent enough time on evaluation, because I think the modeling part came a little too fast to catch up, because we still sometimes use the Rouge and the Blue scores that are typically used, which are like doesn't work for most of these tasks, and especially in the medical domain. So.
And in the, I couldn't agree more with that. I just think it's helpful that they've started pushing that a little bit more, not to suggest, completely in agreement with you, not to suggest that just providing a rationale means the rationale is correct. But even when I see a wrong output, I now appreciate the ability to go and look and try to have a better understanding of why did it come to a wrong conclusion? Oh, it's thinking in a way, and I need to readjust my prompt or just move on from using that large
language. Totally. Things like chain of thought prompting, all that stuff will be super helpful, I think.
Yeah. Different prompting strategies. You brought up neural networks a little bit ago, and I wanted to kind of drill down on that. In a medical context, so at Curie, mostly text-based chat functionality. I'm working on something semi-similar, not overlapping, but we're focused on orthopedics. You kind of have decision tree type modeling, which is more linear. Is this the case? Yes, no. If yes, do this. If no, do that. You go to the next thing, you repeat, rinse and repeat. Neural networks are take more computational power or less linear, probably more powerful though in a lot of ways. Do you see some of these techniques getting left in the dust, like the decision tree modeling, or is this just a function of what do you need it to do? I guess to ask the question more succinctly, like when we get into neural networks, is this the technique that everybody needs to be using if they want to make a worthwhile application?
I need to think about how to answer this question, because I think it's going to be a function of the task. And I feel like these foundational models in NLP space or in any of these later fields has enough structure that you can use it. But there may be disciplines where we haven't learned these models yet and it's not amenable to these models. And there may be some structure that are easy to do with decision trees or something like that. So I'm giving a non-answer here because I'm just trying neutral. Because for me, the thing is about you could imagine, like sometimes you do need these decision trees. It really depends on the task that you have in mind. And what we are finding over and over and again is that starting from representations, like embeddings or representations, because in addition to you are looking for, you are making this thing, is this correct, right? Just writing that down and or even giving the model to train, it just is now requires a large amount of data to do this correctly. Because you can get like the first two layers and after that, the decision trees doesn't work as well. And that's why you have these random forests and you have to keep building upon it and gets mm-hmm. to, I mean, once you go from decision tree to a random forest, which is a collection of decision trees, you've already moved away from a linear surface.
Yes.
So, and we know that random forest is needed if you're using decision tree to make this work, to generalize. And so I would start with thinking about how can the latest one help you and then see what are the challenges and is there a way to get over those challenges or should I really go back to building the very first baseline? This is how I would approach it, right? Because I think very little has gotten out of decision trees, in my opinion, for most work. So
yeah, especially in tech, I guess that's where I asked a pretty convoluted question, and I'm not asking us to relitigate the whole question, but I think that's more so what I was thinking, that in a text-based application, decision trees, meaning for listeners, here's a question, is this true? Yes, no, do this. If not, do this. You start going down the different leaves of the tree, then you brought up random forest, a collection of these decision trees. When we hear about the neural nets, I think people's mind who are moderately familiar with this will go to some of the real world AI applications, whether it's full self-driving that Tesla's been working on for a while, or computer vision is going to use certain neural networks. I think I was getting back to, and you answered it well, but in text-based, where are we with that?
Yeah, I mean, you can see that in genomics as well, right? So you're learning these sequences or protein sequences and learning a language model out of that. You see this in computer vision. I feel like wherever there is ample data that is not labeled, but there's an ample data, the cool thing about this pre-training strategy or the foundational model strategy, which is used to be called as self-supervised learning, is really to say, okay, I see the context so far, I mask the next thing and ask the model to predict the next thing and cross-check and give it a loss function and then improve it. So wherever there is that sequentiality to the data, like where there's like all these unlabeled large amounts of data, I think you can apply trained foundational models on it. And you're seeing this in other disciplines as well. And once you have something like that that's built, I think then it becomes easier to build on top of those as well.
That makes sense. I know we are getting near the end of our time here, Anita. I thought a good way to wrap things up would be, let's imagine it's 2023. You are just starting college. You know that you're interested in machine learning. You know that you're interested in artificial intelligence. Being in the position you are now, knowing what you know now, what should that student go? What would be a good path for them from a practical standpoint? Study, take these classes, study this type of technology to put themselves in a good position moving forward.
You said 2023, this year.
This year, they are freshmen right now.
I would say, like, look for applications because everything here is almost free, right? You have open source models, you have Hugging Face, you have like even ChatGPT or GPT for like Turbo is all really cheap. I would say before you even go and say, I want to get into more ML, ask the question, what can I build with this? Like, even simple things, because it's so much easier to build things. And then you look for like, what are the challenges with building the stuff, right? And then ask, what does it mean? How much of it should I be learning from? And so that's one part of this. And then you may get curious about, why is this working this well? And so you may start digging into it. And then somewhere along the path, when you start doing this, I'm talking about more of having agency and sort of looking through it. The more you go deeper into it, you will realize there's some questions that are still unanswered for you. And that may open up to where do you want to go next? And I feel like that's so much more easier to do now than it was like 2 years ago, for instance.
I have a good follow-up question to that. Should that hypothetical student that we're talking about, should they go and invest thousands of hours into learning specific programming languages or focus on a more general understanding of what they need to know about them just because... in code creation, for instance, they're going to be able to use these large language models. Of course, they still need to know if what they're producing is good, but would you invest those thousands of hours into doing this? Like another parallel to that would be someone investing hundreds or thousands of hours learning Photoshop and Adobe Illustrator right now and these other tools that I've put a lot of time into. I probably would advise them not to put that same time in. Right now.
So it's a good question. For me, I think what we are noticing is that people have to be really good skilled at engineering in some ways. Coding is one part of engineering. Like, how do you build large systems? How do you think about overarching architecture? So even if you're just thinking about evaluation framework for language models, there's a lot to think about on how to set this up in a scalable way, right? So I feel like learning good engineering, how to build really good projects. Engineering is going to be like coding is just one part of it. And yeah, sure, you could do, you know, you could use AI to help you with writing that method or something. But like designing the system requires a human creativity at this point. Right, and that is defined for it. So I would never go shy away from thinking about designing a system. And I think people who are going to be very good at designing. So think about like, say, even if you're training a good larger language model, and probably it's like a few $100 million to train these models, you can make a mistake, which means that there is engineers behind those scenes who are actually architecting it in a way where you can just start the training and it'll work fine. Right. So I think I would never. I still think that people who are extremely good at engineering chops and have like a solid, reasonable understanding of machine learning are going to be a lot more successful than people who are in if you want to do like impactful work.
Yeah, great answer.
You need both, and I always say that if you're strong in one and not another, make sure to be surrounded by people who are strong in the other, so you can complement each other. So you don't have to be perfect in everything, but you just need to be around people. Who are complementary to you and can kind of together, the sum is going to be bigger than the parts.
I think that is a great answer to wrap this up. And I think this whole conversation, in addition to the last answer there, hits on a really important point that if you're not in this space or not quite familiar with it, you may think that this artificial intelligence is kind of happening on its own and running away by itself. But there are actually a lot of people working very hard and putting all of their time and all of their thought professionally into making this work and making it work in a way that is beneficial for everyone. So there are people behind the technology, and you are one of those people. So Anita, thank you for joining us on the Medical AI podcast. This has been great, and I hope you'll come back again.
Yeah, thank you very much, Joe. This was a fun conversation. Really appreciate it. I hope that if anyone wants to reach out to me and talk more about it, happy to do so too. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. This has been the Medical AI podcast. We are Felix Beecher and Joe McKeating. Ping us on LinkedIn if you have any ideas on new guests. See you next time.